everyone. Over the past few weeks, of course, I was reading through Andre Siegfried's The Character of Peoples, and it reminded me of some of the geographic explanations for what certain people are like. And it reminded me of a book I read a good time ago by Thomas Sowell called Wealth, Poverty, and Politics, where he identifies 8 different kind of archetypal groups that reoccur throughout human civilization and human history. There are the mountain people, the coastal people, the river or the valley people, or the people of the lowlands, you might say, the steppes or the nomads, or the steppe nomads, you might want to put it, or the people of the desert is another way of categorizing them. Then you've got islanders, island people. You've got the people of the plains, as distinct from the people of the river. The plains are come with their own challenges and characteristics. Then you have the people of the city, and finally, middlemen, minorities, who are another reoccurring group all the way through history. And I thought it'd be fun to almost treat these 8 groups like factions in a computer game and come up with pros and cons for each group, because Sowell does quite a good job of discussing what are the strengths and weaknesses of each, what are the advantages that each group has, and what are the disadvantages. And one of the things to think about as we think about our own cultures, think about ourselves, think about the society we want to live in, is what is the equilibrium state between these various competing groups within the society. You could talk of them as tendencies within any given nation. At the moment, I don't think it's too difficult to see that we have swung too much towards the coastal and the city and too far away from some of the others. But let's remind ourselves, and I think a fun exercise as we go through this is for you to think, which one am I? Which one of these 8 do I belong to? You know, if you think about your parents and your grandparents and your great-grandparents, and then your own life, of course, where do you fit in? If you had to be in one of these 8, which one would you be? Okay, so let's make a start. First, we have the mountain people. And just before we get going, I'll remind everybody, pick up a course at the academic agency. Trivium, of course, the bestseller there. Also Foundations of Shakespeare. Many other courses are available too. So buy those now. Let's carry on. So you have the mountain people who have numerous strengths. One of their great strengths is their ability to preserve cohesion, their traditions, their culture, going back hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's typically the case that it's the mountain people within the nation that keep things going the longest. Whether you think about the Tibetan mountains or the Himalayas, you think about to some extent the Welsh here in this country, all around the world. You can think of the mountain peoples basically being like the heart and the soul of a place when it comes to maintaining the indigenous culture. They're also very resilient, of course. Surviving in the mountains is difficult, so they're hardy kind of people. And anybody who's watched the Lord of the Rings films, Two Towers, will tell you, defensive advantage. You know, the Battle of Helm's Deep, the mountain peoples tend to be not only be hardy, but because the mountains are easy to defend against attackers, they've got a height advantage. You can build structures into the mountain. You can shoot down, with archers and so on. So yeah, mountain peoples have those things going for them. On the downside, they tend to experience economic stagnation. They have limited cultural exchanges. And because of these two things, there's a certain insularity that creeps in. And this goes hand in hand with the cultural preservation and the traditional part. And that insularity can lead to clannishness, and it can lead to conflict with neighbors, clan conflict. It can lead to things like the mountain people becoming raiders. You know, they go and raid the lowlands, or they'll raid the plains, and then go back up to the mountains. So all of these are potential downsides of the mountain people. You know, you're all thinking immediately of things like Braveheart and things like that. I mean, these are stereotypes, of course, but th there is not just an element of truth. This is the history of peoples. And Sowell, in this book, if you read it, he has dozens upon dozens of examples of mountain peoples from all around the world having these characteristics. Okay. Then we have the coastal people, who in many ways are the kind of polar opposite of the mountain peoples. They're more open. They have cultural dynamism. They're very kind of, you know, they're wanting to experience the exotic and meet people from different cultures. They're cosmopolitan. They have greater economic prosperity as a result of the ease of trading from a coast, seafaring. And as a result of that, they have an advantage in infrastructure development. It starts with the shipping yard. It starts with all of the infrastructure that is required to build up a port and things like that. But then around that port, many other bits of infrastructure start to build. So you can see how that can develop over time. And many of the great cities of the world, of course, are coastal cities. They also, as a result of those two things, the infrastructure development and the economic prosperity, they also then tend to be a political center on the coast. And in America, this is particularly marked, where you have the coastal elites down the East Coast and the West Coast, and then the vast swathe of the rural population in the middle. And again, Sowell in his book talks about how within America, there are literally coastal people who live on the coast, who originally came from places that were by the coast. And then in the middle, there are the Appalachians, who are quite literally mountain peoples from Scotland and elsewhere. Then you have vulnerability to invasion, which is a downside. There is an over-reliance on trade, of course, and being over-reliant on trade means you're not self-sufficient, which means, you know, it's e quicker to come to social collapse if something goes wrong with that trade network. And then finally, the cultural dynamism has a downside, which means you get an erosion of traditions and an erosion of social cohesion, because around ports tend to congregate all sorts of different people, foreigners and so on, coming to trade, various sailors, etc., etc. So, yeah, the coastal people, in many ways, the opposite of the mountain people. Then you have the river people, or the people of the valley, or the lowlanders, if you want, who, much like a river feeds into the sea, often feed into the big coastal center. And obviously, the advantages of living on the river, or being the river people, are obvious. You get agricultural productivity. The river gives you trade and connectivity, especially if you build an irrigation network and a dam network. If you read the history of ancient China, it's basically just like, you know, decades upon decades of massive dam building projects up and down the Yangtze River, you know, and the Yellow River. You can think of the great rivers of Europe, like the Rhine, or the Danube. You can think of the Nile as an extreme example. Most of Egypt is basically built on the River Nile. So you get all of these plus points. You get massive urban development, which leads to cities, of course. And you know, Cairo probably being one of the oldest and biggest river cities in the world. But then on the downside, there's vulnerability to flooding. there are massive overpopulation pressures. And again, in the case of Egypt, that is particularly marked today, where you have a massive population. I think it's like 130 million people, all, you know, forced to live in this tight strip just down the Nile, because a lot of the rest of the country is much harsher conditions and desert and so on. But you know, this has been a long problem in the history of the world, where rivers lead to overpopulation, and there's an over-reliance on waterways, which can be a security concern if some part of that river is in somebody else's territory. Like, somebody could try to block it or divert it or poison it or all sorts of things. And if you can think of it, it has happened in history. And again, you can read the history of China, history of Europe, history of North Africa, and see examples of all of those things that I was just talking about. Then you have the steppe people, or the people of the, or the nomads, or another way of talking about these would be pastoral herders. Whichever way you're talking about a nomad type, typically coming from the steppes. And some of their plus points are obvious if you just think historically. The Mongols come to mind immediately as a steppe people. They have great mobility. They have resilience, same as the mountain people. They're resilient, really hardy. And that makes them great warriors, just like the mountain people are great warriors, great military strength. You know, again, so many, if you read world history, so many of the great conquering peoples in the history of the world have come from the steppes, whether it's the Mongols or the Turks, or originally the Persians came from the steppes, the original Persians, and many others as well. I mean, the history of great invasions, you know, coming out of what is today Russia, is basically a history of the great conquerors of world history in many ways. But then on the downside, the nomadic way of life leads to economic stability. There tend to be transient interactions with other cultures, because they're always coming or going. So you get a kind of superficial or transient relationship. What Sowell talks about when he discusses this is a lack of kind of permanent cultural exchange, right? Nothing is sustained. And as a result of that, there's a certain type of cultural isolation, because those people, the nomads, end up sticking to themselves and not accepting the ways of the outcomers and so on. Even stories when the Mongols took over cities and things like that, where they would remaining on the edge of town in their tents, not mixing with the locals and things like that. And then finally, you have a conflict with settled groups, which is self-evident. So again, the pros of the steppes really obvious, the negatives of the steppes really obvious too. Then we get the island people, and I've put a picture of the British Navy there. Now, you should really think about historical Britain or historical Japan rather than their current incarnations. Cultural cohesion is one of the great advantages of an island nation, because they have this is something Arnold Toynbee talks about. They have time and space to incubate as a culture, as a society, to really create a homogeneous group. And again, historically, Britain was very good for this. Historically, Japan is a great example. Okay. Other examples are available, and he goes in the book, Sowell goes through all of these. Obviously, when it comes to seafaring, especially when the technology gets good enough to go on the oceans, there's a massive maritime advantage. And we saw this historically with the enormous British Empire. And indeed, Japan had a decent empire as well that was defeated in World War II. But Imperial Japan expanded rapidly when they got going. It took vast swathes of the land around them and invaded China and all the rest of it. Not much taught, but it's a kind of interesting thing to look into. And then, of course, the defensive isolation means that historically, an island like Japan has been very difficult to invade. Island like Britain has been very difficult to invade. Island nations are difficult to invade. So there's a defensive advantage as well, especially given that if you have the maritime advantage, you've probably got the better navy. And that has been the case, well, up until quite recently in world history. On the downside, there is cultural stagnation. And this can especially be the case with some island groups that, I mean, Seoul doesn't just look at Britain and Japan. He looks at many, many other island peoples as well. And obviously, if they're not, I mean, Britain and Japan have advantages about being close to their respective continents. Japan is just a short sail away from, or a relatively short sail away from China. Britain is a relatively short sail away from France. So it doesn't take long to come into contact with other people. Whereas some islands are much more isolated, or it would take much longer to get to meet anyone else. And as a result of that, you can get cultural stagnation. There's also resource scarcity to think about. If it's not on the island, then you have to invade somewhere else or trade it in, which can be a disadvantage. And of course, islands are vulnerable to naval blockades, uniquely vulnerable to that. And these disadvantages stack, of course, because if you need to trade something in, well, if you blockade that thing, then you can cripple a country based on that. And all of these things are still relevant today. They're still relevant today. Like, for example, that whole BlackRock plan that they had of bringing the food in from places like Ukraine and selling off the farmland to make it real estate or something. Well, that would make Britain, dependent on food imports. Terrible idea for an island nation to be not food self-sufficient. Just terrible idea, because if some bigger power got the idea of blockading Britain, well, and we were dependent not on our own farms for food, but on some foreign country for food, then the country could be starved out quickly and easily. And these things have been historically important. They were important in both the world wars, for example. Then there is the plains people, and some of their advantages are also pretty obvious, I think. Self-sufficiency, cultural stability, abundant resources and access to those resources. You can set up farms, you can actually build a lot from agriculture. So the plains have a lot going for them, but they do suffer from economic stagnation as well, similar to some of the other groups that we've looked at. They can be culturally isolated. If you think of rural people, always everywhere in history, it's the country bumpkin, it's the peasant, it's the farmhand. They tend, because you're a long way from the big centers of civilization, so you're much less likely to meet foreigners and things like that out in the sticks, which can lead to a kind of insularity. Also the plains people are vulnerable to exploitation. And when they say exploitation, what Seoul is talking about really is exploitation from the big political centers, from the coastal peoples, who, take advantage in all sorts of different ways. And it has been the case historically that the plains people have been ruled over by the coastal people or the river people. Okay, kind of an interesting. The mountain people tend to be warriors, right? So the mountain people, even though they're up in the mountains and even though they're isolated and so on, they still have political nous because they're clannish, they're groupish, they know how to work together, and they can also fight. So they're much harder to manipulate. Whereas the plains people historically have unfortunately been the politically subjugated, the peasantry, the ruled, as opposed to the rulers. And it's an interesting thing to think about because this structure is still replicated today. Even today, the coastal peoples rule over the middle in America, or in this country, London absolutely dominates the countryside, absolutely dominates it. Same in France, Paris dominates rural southern France and rural France. And the same everywhere. The same everywhere in China, the big cities dominate the rural areas as well. So anyway, let's carry on. Then speaking of the city, now the city is a later development, and it can typically be built in the coastal area or on the river, as we talked about, or in some cases, in most cases, when it comes to the mega cities, you get both at the same time. London, for example, is not only a coastal city, it is also an estuary city built on the Thames. It's London on Thames. So you have the big river there going out to the sea. So it has both coastal access and river access. And you can pick your own favorite examples. New York would be another one, big coastal city, but you've got the Hudson River going straight into it. Very often the case, the biggest and most successful cities are both coastal and river. Fans of Sid Meier's Civilization, right? Your biggest cities are typically the ones built on the mouth of a river right on the coast. So you can sail out and explore and trade, but you also get the benefits of the big the big flood plains that can support farms and all the rest of it. So you get the double benefit. Anyway, cities, they have massive concentration of what they call human capital. They have greater economic opportunities and, of course, cultural exchange. Now, a lot of people watching this, obviously, we're living at a time where there's been too much immigration and people have had enough of multiculturalism and cosmopolitanism and so on. But that's because we've experienced it, we've known it. A lot of people throughout history have been on the opposite end of the extreme, where it's just one thing all of the time, and there's no variety whatsoever. It's very difficult to get your mind back or to get your mind into that space of truly being culturally isolated, and how exciting it might be to meet people from different backgrounds and different places. Okay, what I'm saying is there is an actual upside to the cultural exchange. It's not only bad, and that's why it is in the plus. On the minus side, it leads to social tensions, and cities everywhere and always have competing groups who don't get on. Okay. And they also tend to be more violent places, higher crime, etc. Not just now, but also all throughout history. There's an argument to say that a city like London has always been abysmal. It's always been bad. Okay. Also, overcrowding is a persistent problem in cities, and economic volatility. Because cities are economic zones, really, they can swing with market fluctuations, which means that everybody can be hit at the same time, if they're particularly reliant on some product or other. Okay. And, obviously, the bigger cities will be more robust. But again, historically, there have been cities built on this industry or that industry. There's a hit in that industry, or circumstances change, and now that city has gone to pot. Detroit is the example that immediately comes to mind, but many, 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 many other examples are available, both in modern history and in ancient history as well. So many cities that were big, big cities no longer even exist or are, condemned to the history books because the thing that made them great stopped being viable or something changed. Okay. And the reason why that is there for the city is because in some of these other things, like the basic advantages of the river or the island or the plains, for example, I mean, they're kind of set in stone. They're kind of like a feature of the land. Okay, you'd have to really badly screw up your agriculture to, take away the natural advantages of the plain or the river, for example. Okay, and that has happened too, but you have to really seriously screw up, not doing proper farming techniques and eroding the soil as one example, right? But those sorts of cases are rarer, where people has completely screwed up a entire area to make it uninhabitable. Much more common in history has been the city that arises around a particular industry, and now circumstances have changed. I don't want to labour the point too much. Finally, we have the middlemen minorities, and obviously everybody thinks immediately of the Jewish people. All throughout history, but there are other ones. I mean, I've got a picture here of the Asians, the Indians in Africa, who acted as middlemen. Famously, they were kicked out by people like Idi Amin and others in the 60s and 70s. A lot of our politicians, like Priti Patel, springs to mind, were diaspora of middlemen minorities who were kicked out of Africa, who then came to live in Britain. The Chinese have been middlemen whenever they've gone outside of China, and Seoul does a really good job of itemizing all of the different ones that there have been. And what he says is like the middlemen minority actually do fulfill a specific function, and they're valued for their economic expertise. And one of the reasons that they're able to be middlemen is they have transnational or international networks and a strength of that network across borders that is tied to wherever they're from. So, for example, the Asians in Africa weren't just operating in Uganda, they would have been operating in other countries too. And so they were network effects, same as Jews in Europe all the way through history. And indeed, you could argue today as well. And same as the Chinese in some of the Southeast Asian countries too. So the network part is definitely a strength because it means that they're able to provide capital quickly, right? They have quick liquidity and capital up front in a way that the local population would not be able to provide. 9 times out of 10, this is a recurring thing that happens throughout history, and of course they have adaptability. They're able to react quicker because they'll be able to see things that the locals can't see, and so these three things, the economic expertise, the network strength, and the adaptability, combine to make these people really, really successful, regardless of where they go, really, because these things are advantages. Disadvantages are it breeds social resentment, as we talked about with the Asians being kicked out of Africa, Chinese have been kicked out of so many different countries in history, and of course, everybody will know about the expulsion of Jews historically in Europe, not just in Europe, wherever they've gone as well. And then you have economic dependence, which is an issue because it means that that group is vulnerable because they're dependent on the majority or the host nations. And of course, when that social resentment tips, the vertical alliance can break down, and the king or the ruler or Idi Amin or whoever it happens to be, King Edward, can decide, right, that's it, I have to. Okay, you're providing us benefits in these areas, but you got to go, basically. So this is a minus point. And then a third minus point is cultural isolation, which is limited integration with the majority population, which is one of the downsides of the network strength that I talked about earlier on. And this is depicted if you read Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice as one example that springs to mind. Shylock, who is a Jewish merchant in Venice, during the Renaissance. One of the issues is that he doesn't want to mix with the locals. The locals don't like him. He doesn't like the locals. All his friends are from the same background as him. And, this is quote unquote multiculturalism. And this leads to other issues, and it increases that social resentment that we talked about. This is a really interesting thing, and I thought that it would be an interesting exercise. Where do you fit in? And it could be that in today's kind of atomized world, even if you're from a long line of mountain people, you identify as a middleman, say, or you identify as a steppe nomad. I mean, it's theoretically possible that you feel that way, in which case, knock yourself out. But in the comments, let me know where you think you stand. The source for all of this ultimately was Thomas Sowell's Wealth, Poverty, and Politics. His sources, in turn, he draws a lot from the Annales school historian Fernand Braudel. I will see you again soon. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.